The following Dharma talk was recorded in August 2015 in Springfield, Illinois, from the retreat called Suffering and the End of Suffering, taught by Bridget Rollins. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Bridget Rollins has practiced insight meditation since 1997. Her mentors include Matthew Flickstein, Ginny Morgan, and Gloria Terania Ambrosia. She is recognized by the Spirit Rock Teachers Council as a community Dharma leader, and her website is www.pathwaystomindfulness.com.
I'd like to begin the talk by recapping a little bit from yesterday, and recalling that the Buddha said he had only fully awakened after becoming entirely clear about the 12 aspects of the four. And if we remember, there are like three aspects to each of the four with regards to dukkha. And I really like Stephen Batchelor's translation of dukkha in this context as life, life as it is. So, such is dukkha. It can be fully known. It has been fully known. With regards to the arising of craving, such is the arising of craving. It can be let go of. It has been let go of. With regards to the ceasing of craving, such is the ceasing of craving. It can be experienced. It has been experienced. And with regards to the path, such is the path. It can be cultivated. It has been cultivated. So, you know, the last of all those three says, this has been done. The task has been accomplished. And the Buddha said, awakening happens when one has done all that needs to be done. And I think you hear that little refrain in some of the Pali Canon. Someone in their song of awakening will say, what had to be done was done. And we can remember the little acronym ELSA, let it go, let it go. So we can see the four as tasks to be practiced rather than truths to be somehow believed in. And there is the task of embracing life on life's terms. There is the task of letting go. There is the task of stopping, or rather, it's not that we stop the craving, but by letting go, we are able to witness the stopping or the ceasing. And then there is the acting, which is the Noble Eightfold Path, or the Eightfold Path of Action. Today, what I'd like to contemplate with you is the third of the tasks, to experience the cessation or the stopping of craving. And Ajahn Sumedho has written a little book. You can get a PDF of it off of the internet. And it's called The Four Noble Truths. So he's using the old language. He and Stephen Batchelor haven't gotten together yet. And I'd just like to read just a little piece, excerpt from that about cessation, and then explore it, unpack it a bit. So he says, cessation is easy to understand on an intellectual level, but to realize it may be quite difficult because this entails abiding with what we think we cannot bear. Anybody have that experience yet? He says, as long as we do not allow things to cease, we just create new karma that just reinforces our habits. When something arises, we grasp it and proliferate around it, and this complicates everything. Then these things will be repeated and repeated and repeated through our lives. We cannot go around following our desires and fears and expect to realize peace. He says it's very important to differentiate between cessation and annihilation. Annihilation is the desire that comes into the mind to get rid of something. Anybody have a desire in your mind to get rid of something that's been arising over on the retreat? Cessation is the natural ending of any condition that has arisen. It's not something we create in the mind, but it is the end of that which began, the death of that which was born. It does not mean rejecting or throwing away, but rather letting go. Then, when it has ceased, you experience nirodha, cessation, emptiness, non-attachment. When you have let something go and allowed it to cease, then what is left is peace. So I'd like to just unpack this. He starts by saying cessation is easy to understand on an intellectual level. I mean, if you hear someone say everything that arises ceases, I mean, it's hard to dispute that. Yeah, I know that. But to realize may be quite difficult because this entails abiding with what we think we cannot bear. That points us to the first of the four. We think we cannot bear the realities of aging, death, illness, separation from what we want, association with what we don't want, not getting what we want, the pain, loss, blame, failure of living a human life. And because we hold the belief that we can't bear these realities, we run away from them. We try to escape them. We look for a refuge from them. And when our minds and hearts are obscured by ignorance, we seek refuge in that which is not a true refuge. We seek we find ways to gain a temporary release from the difficulty, from the pain. But we'll explore this a little more as we go on. He says, as long as we do not allow things to cease, we just create new kamma or karma that just reinforces our habits. When something arises, we grasp it and proliferate around it, and this complicates everything. Then these things will be repeated and repeated throughout our lives. We cannot go around following our desires and fears and expect to realize peace. And I think it's helpful to make a distinction between desire as simply a wish to do, a desire to act, the wish to achieve an aim. I've heard teachers say that in Pali there's a word chanda, C-H-A-N-D-A, and that's sometimes translated as, it's just that inclination to act, that wish to do. So there's nothing wrong when your stomach's growling, you know, and you experience the desire to eat something. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, that is a desire to act. And that's pointing us in a direction of taking care of ourselves, you know, caring for this body. If we're outside and it's, 6 degrees above zero and we have no coat, we're going to feel cold and we'll probably feel the arising of a desire to put a coat on or go indoors. This is a safety mechanism. So there is desire, which is simply that, wish to act. And that's a little different than what we might call craving. And I understand craving is the desire with an attachment to the object of the desire. So that desire to act is there, but it becomes this burning thirst to have that object. And there's an attachment, a clinging that goes along with it. And Ajahn Sumedho says that these reinforce habits. So we could look a little bit, and this is really, I think, neuroscience backs this up, that, and you might call to mind an experience of an arising of craving for you. For many of us, it has to do with food, cookies, you know, Snickers bar. For some of us, it's something else, and I wish I was you. So, you know, the thought of maybe there's a little hunger, or there's even not even any hunger at all, not any physical hunger. The thought of, you know, my favorite chocolate chunk cookie comes into the mind. And there's a desire to go get a chocolate chunk cookie from Penn Station. Actually, I don't even like those, but it's a good example. So it starts as this desire to act. And then we notice that desire starts to increase. And now we've got a craving for the cookie. And there's an attachment to getting that cookie, the object of our desire. And have you noticed that the more you're craving something and the more you're attached to getting it, the more tension there is in the system? It's not a very pleasant feeling. Craving isn't a very pleasant feeling. So there's that tension. There is this unpleasant, and we want to get rid of the tension. We want to get rid of the craving. So we go get the cookie, and we eat the cookie, and it works. The craving is satisfied. And we feel the relaxation, the release of eating that chocolate chunk cookie. This is just how human bodies work. However, it doesn't mean that we will never crave a chocolate chip cookie again. So the satisfying of that craving by eating the cookie is a temporary happiness that we get. And it is a form of happiness. So let's just acknowledge that. It's not bad. It is a form of happiness. However, if we're looking for a happiness that is not conditioned, we don't want to go this route. So here's what happens. The brain makes a connection. Tension, unpleasant feeling, cookie, eat cookie, relaxation, feel good. And the next time craving arises, we may not even think about getting a cookie or not getting a cookie. We just react, get the cookie. And it might be that what we're doing is we are feeding that habit of craving. And we're using a cookie to relieve ourselves of that craving. And unfortunately, it seems like these, you know, the chemistry of our body, the nervous system isn't satisfied for some of us. It's just we get into an addictive cycle or a compulsive cycle. So yes, we have the one cookie. And then we're not hungry, but we're just feeling stressed out from the day. And we don't feel good. Mind remembers, cookie works, and we go get the cookie. And we get that temporary fix. But then it goes away. So then we have to eat another cookie, you know, and temporary fix. And then we eat another cookie. And by now, the cookies aren't even relieving the tension. But we've gotten into this habit of using cookie to satisfy craving, and now we're still not feeling good, but the mind, the heart, the body is still grasping, I want to get some pleasure. And in ignorance, it'll just keep eating the cookies, even though that strategy isn't even though that strategy isn't working anymore. So grasping at pleasure becomes a habit, and it becomes, you know, our only strategy for dealing with the difficulties, the pain, the burden of our lives, the stress of life. And this is really in accordance with the law of karma or kama. Actions that come out of intentions feed the intention and create a condition that those actions, those intentional actions, will be repeated. So if I use a cookie this time to relieve my boredom, the next time I'm bored, I will probably use a cookie again. Which might not be a problem. But if I find that I'm eating bags of cookies, you know, searching for relief from suffering, it might be that it's become a problem. If an action, and this is just something to verify for yourself, but the Buddha verified for himself that if an action is rooted in greed, hatred, or delusion, and we nourish that root, then our future actions will be motivated by greed, hatred, and delusion, and we will suffer. So it's very important. You know, I was talking with someone on retreat who's kind of struggling with all of this, and we were just reflecting on the fact that, you know, there's the surface difficulty, and we might have all of our attention focused on fixing the circumstance, fixing the situation. Sometimes that's the most skillful thing to do, and a way that we practice non-harming towards ourselves or someone else. However, it's not getting at the root. So why is there dissatisfaction with this situation? Why is there suffering around this situation? The suffering is coming because I'm either clinging to having a pleasant experience, or I'm resisting, I'm hating, you know, the experience and trying to push it away and get rid of it. Or I don't know what the heck's going on, which is ignorance, delusion, and I'm very confused and don't know where the suffering's coming from. So it's important to drop down and be able to investigate and see what is this arising out of? What is the root? What's the root intention, the root mental state that this is arising out of? And if it is greed, hatred, or delusion, then we want to go to another retreat where the whole retreat is about skillfully working with that. Or we want to go home and continue to explore, what's a skillful way of working with greed, hatred, and delusion. When I was reading this, I remembered some wisdom, a story that echoes this wisdom from the Cherokee Nation. You may be familiar with this story. It goes like this. An elder Cherokee chief took his grandchildren into the forest and sat them down and said to them, "A fight is going on inside of me. This is a terrible fight, and it's a fight between two wolves. One wolf is the wolf of fear, anger, arrogance, and greed. The other wolf is the wolf of courage, kindness, humility, and love." The children were very quiet and listening to their grandfather with both their ears. He then said to them, "This same fight between the two wolves is going on that's going on inside of me is going on inside of you and every person." They thought about it for a minute, and then one child asked the chief, "Grandfather, which wolf will win the fight?" He said quietly, "The one you feed." So the problem, again, is not having pleasant experiences, or even, you know, doing something to ameliorate an unpleasant experience. The problem is the craving, the grasping, the attachment to having pleasure, or the attachment to, you know, things becoming or being the way we want them to be, or not being the way we want them to be. And the problem with that is that that craving for pleasure, becoming and non-becoming, might keep us looking for more and more to the extent that we harm ourselves or others. And, you know, the Buddha gave advice to his son Rahula about that. He said, when the desire to act arises, be mindful, pay attention, and first check in. Will this action I'm about to take, and it might be a verbal action, it could be a physical action, it could even be a mental action, will this action harm me, harm others, or harm us both? Or will it benefit me, benefit others, benefit both? And he says, if the action is going to harm, then he uses pretty strong language, like, this is absolutely not appropriate to do. That's not what the translation is, but that's my memory of the feel for it. But if it's going to benefit me, benefit others, benefit both of us, then that action, that's okay to take. Do that. The Dharma teacher Temple Smith, and I highly recommend his talks. You'll find them on Dharma Seed. But Temple Smith tells a story about himself and his experience of working with craving. And his teacher, Upandita, who was a Burmese teacher, I think is a Burmese teacher. So Temple Smith had been introduced to the Dharma and Buddhist teachings out in California, I believe, where a lot of the Western folks came. He was probably going from coast to coast, Spirit Rock to Insight Meditation Society. But at some point, he just really resonated with it, and it just really caught him. And at some point, he thought, you know what? I'm really loving what these teachers are saying, and I want to go to their teachers. So he knew Upandita was one of the teachers of the Western teachers, and he went there. And I think he said something like, that's where I'll really get the Dharma. So he went to Burma, and he was there for an extended retreat, and I can't remember how long, but, you know, it was probably a month or so. That was his intention. And so, you know, he goes to the meditation hall to practice. And all of a sudden, he starts hearing hammering and sawing and people talking. And they were remodeling the dining room right next door. And it was like, what? You know, I came thousands of miles, you know, and went to all this trouble to come to Burma to meditate. And they've got a construction project going on right next door. I can't meditate with all that noise going on. And, you know, he struggled with it. So he went to his teacher, Upandita, and he said, I can't practice with all that commotion going on. Isn't there something you can do? Is there some other place I can go? And, you know, kind of poured out his heart with all the difficulty. And Upandita, with great compassion, you know, listened, nodding his head, said, needs more mindfulness. And he sent him back to the meditation hall next to the dining room. And Temple Smith had to go back and practice with that. And I think, now I'm not remembering his exact thing, but what I remember from what he said was, you know, he had to work with the craving for things to be other than what they were, for his desire to have this meditation hall be a particular way. So he was working with craving, you know, the desire for spiritual pleasure of or just really even the physical pleasure of a quiet environment. The craving for how he thought it should be. So Upandita, in his wisdom, by putting him back there rather than saying, listen, we got a room away from all the commotion that you can sit in, which could have been an alternative, But Upandita sent him back so that he could realize the problem isn't the construction. The problem is my relationship to the construction. And so he got to get very intimate with the craving that was arising within him. And he must have been able to do those two tasks of letting go of attachment to his craving, because he experienced at some point being perfectly fine with all the commotion. He didn't have a problem at all sitting in a meditation hall with all that going on. He said, in fact, when they stopped the construction, I kind of missed it. So a desire in him rose to become a monk and really devote his life to this practice. So he took robes, and he says, you know, I'm a guy from New Jersey. I'm used to cold. However, that very first morning, well, Burma's really hot, and those little light robes are nice during the day, but the first morning they go on alms round, he said, just that little bit of cloth between me and the coolness of the morning, I was freezing. And he said, yes, I'm from New Jersey. I know how to deal with cold, but I had a full head of hair at that time, a hat and a coat. So immediately comes up, the mind starts proliferating around this. And, you know, he's saying, I'm not going to be able to handle this going out every morning and walking, what, mile or so into the village, to get alms and coming back. I'm going to catch my death in pneumonia. And so he goes into to Upandita and says, you know, I'm freezing. That little rope is not enough. And Upandita, you know, needs more mindfulness. So he didn't give him an extra robe or a coat. He said, go out. And I don't think it took Temple as long to, again, come to equanimity and contentment and peace with it. That he was able to notice body is cold. And right now, there's nothing that is to be done about that. And I can be with cold body. So he was able to let go of attachment to the desire to have a different experience in the morning. And it wasn't a problem. It wasn't that it was any more pleasant. And see, here's the thing. Sometimes we get in order to mind, okay, I am going to accept this cold, cold, cold so that it will go away. And we mistakenly say so that the cold will go. We won't feel cold anymore. No, that's not how it works. We're still going to feel cold. We're practicing in order to let go of our attachment and thus experience a cessation of the suffering that gets added on to an unpleasant experience. So, one more time, they're going out for alms round, and during the previous day, the street people had come and put down crushed rock. And then later they would come and put asphalt over that. So here they are walking in bare feet over crushed rock to get their alms. And Temple says, and I thought, ow, ooh, oh, this is sharp. And he said, and I didn't even go to Upandita. I just told myself, needs more mindfulness. But here's the thing. He said that this is what renunciation looks like. You know, this is the practice of restraint, of letting go, which is another word for renunciation. He was letting go of having the pleasant experience. And he said he developed a contentment that was very deep and that was not dependent on his environment and his external circumstances. That I love to tell that story because I love to hear it again myself and be inspired by the fact that, oh yeah, I too can develop a deep contentment, that can be there no matter what my circumstances are. That's the kind of happiness and refuge I'm looking for. And it's just this dear heart and mind keep forgetting. And then they go to all the refuges that don't really follow through. So Ajahn Sumedho says, it's very important here to differentiate between cessation and annihilation. Okay, so the desire that comes into the mind to get rid of something is annihilation. And that's a form of aversion. So I want to get rid of this. I want to get rid of this aversion. It's like we have aversion and now we have aversion on top of aversion. Cessation is the natural ending of any condition that arises. And here is a noble truth. Here is the Dharma, the truth of the way things are. Anything that arises will cease. There's nothing in this physical world, in this mental world, that comes up that will not cease. Now, it might take a long time for it to cease, but everything that arises passes away. That is the truth of the way things are. Cessation is not something that's created in the mind. So we don't make cessation happen. We simply stay present to the truth of the way things are. And if we do that, what we will do is we will experience cessation. And I love what he says. Then when craving has ceased, you experience nirodha, cessation, emptiness, non-attachment. When you have let something go and allowed it to cease, then what is left is peace. And I might say, what is left is freedom. And the Buddha said that just as the great ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt, so this doctrine and discipline, what I teach, has but one taste, the taste of freedom. And that makes me think of, our beloved Gloria Taranilla, who says, the mind is not stupid. If you give it good, clean data, it's going to naturally tend towards freedom. So as we actually experience the cessation of craving, which comes from letting go of our attachment to our desire, then the mind, the heart, perhaps even the body, get a taste for cessation. Connect that with letting go of desire. You know, one kind of feeds on the other. And we'll naturally incline. So it's, in a sense, it doesn't take hard work. It takes, as Jean was remembering Taranilla saying, relax. Relax and pay attention. Relax and pay attention. This stuff is all impersonal. It's not you. And if you can relax and pay attention, as Ajahn Chah says, stay in your seat and watch it. Don't get up and get attached and get involved and get into the dance. Stay in your seat and watch it, and that's how wisdom will arise. And the discipline of meditation is helping us cultivate and develop that ability to stay in our seat and to observe. So, kind of taking these two tasks, we've kind of honed into the middle two tasks, letting go of attachment to desire and experiencing cessation. We might go back to our tapusa, the householder tapusa, and we might now understand that the difference between the young monastics whose hearts leapt up at renunciation and grew confident, steadfast, and firm, and saw renunciation as peace, The difference between them and the householder Tipusa, who sees renunciation as a sheer drop-off, and contrary to everything that seems to be the life of a householder, the difference is that through their discipline of renunciation, through their practice of letting go of reacting to desire for sensual pleasure, for becoming, for non-becoming, the young monks experienced cessation. They experienced the freedom, the non-attachment, the peace. They experienced a taste of nibbana, which is also, that's Pali, the Sanskrit is nirvana. And it's like, yeah, I want nibbana, I want nibbana. Well, if you want nibbana, practice two and three of the tasks. But they had experienced a taste of nibbana as soon as they began to really practice renunciation and really see what is the reward of this. And it's interesting that the nibbana is actually a household term that means cooling. Joseph Goldstein explained that, and he said, you know, you'll hear someone say, let the rice get a little more nibbana before you eat it. You know, let the rice cool off. So nibbana is a cooling. And in the context of the four, we can see nibbana as cooling the fires of craving. If we don't right now see renunciation as peace, and right now it might be intellectually, we can kind of say, well, yeah, I can see that. But, you know, when it comes to living life in the real world, we find, I'm not so inclined to practice renunciation. But if we don't see renunciation as peace right now, we can do what the Buddha did. We can investigate our real life experience, the experience of sensual pleasure, the experience of trying to arrange things so that they become what we want, or arrange things so that they don't become what we don't want, and get familiar with the drawbacks of that. You know, and it might mean that we just give ourselves completely over 10 bags of chocolate chunk cookies and just really say, you know what, I'm just going to be completely mindful as I do this and just see what the reward is. You know, and there's a part of me that says, you know, there's no reward. I mean, you already know this, Bridget, but then there's the part that still is caught in craving and will eat that chocolate chunk cookie even though I'm already full. So Bridget, listen to your talk. That's why teaching is a form of practice. And, okay, so let's experiment with renunciation. You know, I don't know about this thing, but okay, I'm going to do it. Not doing it with scrunching down and tensing up, but remembering that renunciation is letting go of acting out. And what happens when I just let myself be with the craving without acting it out? Find out if there are rewards. You know, if we find that, you know what, I am a little happier. I didn't eat that cookie. And I am happier. This is something that this is why the mental factor of investigation is called a factor of awakening, that we really need to investigate these things for ourselves. So, you know, the fourth of the four is cultivating the path. And cultivating the path supports the completion of the first three. It's the way that we can do everything that has to be done. So we cultivate wisdom about the truth of the way things are, and as best we can align the thoughts that feed intention with that truth, so that our intentions, our thoughts are wholesome, that they lead to happiness and freedom. We also align our actions with intentions that are non-harming. This is the practice of morality, the precepts. And we train the mind so that it can see clearly how suffering comes into being and how it is brought to cessation. And we do that with training the mind in right effort, concentration, mindfulness. That's the mental training. Meditation, we can do that formally, where we simplify our environment and, find a quiet place if we can, and do the formal practice. However, the formal practice is not enough unless you are a monastic and can do it 24/7, and even they can't do it because of they've got other duties. So it's important for us to let the formal meditation practice simply prime the pump for us to carry the practice into life, into as many moments of life as we can. So to the extent that we perfect these eight factors of the path, we will taste that freedom. And when we have done all that can be done, we will be fully liberated from suffering and will never return again to a state of suffering. And the Buddha said this is possible. He said, I would not encourage you to do this, walk this path, if it weren't possible. So we kind of begin to go into closing this retreat. I just want to extend a wish. May each one of us come to the end of suffering, and may all beings come to the end of suffering.